CFUV 101.9 FM broadcasts from the Songhees and Wasanich territories, also known as Victoria, BC. You can listen to our music, spoken word, and multicultural programs anywhere, anytime at cfuv.ca.
This program reflects the views and opinions of the participants and not necessarily those of CFUV. Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded March 16th, 2022. Well, Israeli forces stormed Jerusalem's Al-Aqsa Mosque during Friday prayers last week. It was the culmination of attacks against Palestinians in towns, villages, and cities across the West Bank during Ramadan. Palestinian attacks within Israel since the beginning of the Holy Fasting Month have too increased. As of writing, 30 people are dead on both sides, and it's feared this could be a prelude to a larger conflict. Mustafa Barghouti, Secretary General of the Palestinian National Initiative, says the confrontations over these last 2 weeks could, quote, become a wide-ranging intifada. Last year, military raids against worshippers in Al-Aqsa escalated to an 11-day conflict that included Israel's Air Force bombing Gaza, killing hundreds, including at least 65 children. Dr. Ramzi Baruth is a journalist, author, and editor of the Palestine Chronicle at palestinechronicle.com. His book titles include My Father Was a Freedom Fighter, The Last Earth, A Palestinian Story, These Chains Will Be Broken, Palestinian Stories of Struggle and Defiance in Israel's Prisons, and his latest, co-edited with Ilan Pape, Our Vision for Liberation, Engaged Palestinian Leaders and Intellectuals Speak Out. Ramzi's articles also appear across the internet and at his website, ramzibaruth.net, where I found his recent piece, Gaza's Forthcoming Crisis Might Be Worse Than Anything We Have Ever Seen. Ramzi Baruth in the first half. And April begins the eighth year of the world's most dire humanitarian disaster, the asymmetrical conflict in Yemen. There, backed by Western nations, Saudi Arabia has led a coalition of wealthy Arab states in a protracted war that has cost the lives of hundreds of thousands of civilians and threatens millions more. Azza Rajbi is a social justice and anti-racism activist, author, and secretary of Mobilization Against War and Occupation. Azza Rajbi and Canada feeding the fire of war in Yemen in the second half. But first, Ramzi Baruth and Gaza Without Water. Welcome back to the program, Ramzi.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Before getting to your article, Gaza's Forthcoming Crisis Might Be Worse Than Anything We Have Ever Seen, what's behind the latest fighting in Palestine?
Well, the latest fighting is just something is to be expected. There's a certain point in which Israeli violence is going to generate counter-Palestinian violence. I mean, this is the story that has proven to, you know, be the only constant truth about this so-called conflict for over 70 years. That is, Israel keeps putting pressure on Palestinians, keep confiscating more of their land, keep expanding its illegal Jewish settlements, and of course, meeting out this daily violence that just is just part of, you know, everyday life for any Palestinian anywhere in the occupied territories. And all of this with no political horizon whatsoever, no international pressure or potential international pressure that would allow Palestinians to at least psychologically cope with all of this, thinking that something is forthcoming, none of it. So naturally, something is going to give. Palestinians will stand up, will fight back. And they do. I mean, they do. You know, it's unfair to presume that, a shooter in Tel Aviv or in Nakab, for example, is the Palestinian way of fighting back. They fight back every single day. There's a recent article I wrote about the resistance of Palestinian everydayness, you know, the thousands upon thousands of acts of resistance and defiance that take place every day by ordinary people in the way they insist on living their lives, crossing to their agricultural land, standing up to the Israelis, protesting. Most of this goes unnoticed, of course. It takes a single Palestinian with a gun or a knife to bring a little bit of attention back to this issue. But sadly, it's always negative attention, as in Palestinian violence against Israelis, which instigates Israeli retaliation. and so forth. It's just the same old story. Now, what's happening in Palestine in particular is interesting because it's different from the past few decades. The resistance in Palestine is now collective. This idea that only Gaza is resisting and everybody else is watching is over, and it's particularly because of the rebellion of May of last year, where Palestinians rose together from Sheikh Jarrah in East Jerusalem to the besieged Gaza Strip, but also to and equally, if not slightly more important, to Palestinian communities and towns inside Israel, which kind of really defeated this whole idea that certain Palestinians have been pacified or incorporated into some kind of an Israeli superstructure, and they are not part of the Palestinian resistance anymore. All of this has changed the nature of the discourse, political discourse, but the nature of the chants and the slogans used by Palestinians from a refugee camp in Gaza to an Arab community in Haifa is now very, very similar. The demands are very similar. And this is what's so upsetting to Israel, because it now feels it's back to 1948, when Palestinians were one nation, being oppressed together or fighting together. So that is the new phenomenon that is very worrying to Israel. And the more violence they used against Palestinians to maybe, satisfy their political constituencies in Israel, the more Palestinian unity they generate and the more Palestinian resistance they create throughout Palestine. So it's kind of a major Israeli dichotomy. They are not oblivious to it, but they are stuck because violence is the only way that Israel feels that works against Palestinians. So they carry on with violence, knowing that this is going to generate and deepen Palestinian unity, and that is generating greater Palestinian response and so forth.
Last month, there was 20-some-odd people killed in Palestine by settler violence, too.
That's right, and the number of Palestinian casualties has been rising exponentially in recent months. In the area of Jenin and other parts of the northern West Bank, for example, I mean, every few days there is a fight or two, a teenager, a woman, an old man, a farmer, and so forth. And usually, we report on this at the Palestine Chronicle. A few alternative media, of course, Palestinian media report on it, but it's absent from mainstream coverage, almost entirely absent from mainstream coverage. This is why, sadly, we're back in the same old cycle where it takes a Palestinian to stand up and to do something in order for the media to actually pay attention and, again, pin the story as if it is, Palestinians are aggressors and Israel is in a state of self-defense. But I think Al-Aqsa Mosque is particularly important to this story. Why Al-Aqsa Mosque? I mean, the people who have attacked Israeli targets and soldiers and officers and others in Israel in the last couple of weeks, they do not come from East Jerusalem, let alone they don't come from the facilities of Al-Aqsa Mosque. They're not related to any worshippers going to Al-Aqsa Mosque. So why go to the mosque and injure 150 people, including journalists, old people, religious scholars, and arrest over 400 people? What's the point of doing so? And in my mind, this is the historical context of this. Israel has a large number of Jewish extremists who, back in the day, before 1967, but really all the way until kind of mid-70s, late 80s, represented a fraction, a small fraction of Israeli political elites. They were outside the discussion as far as people who influenced political thinking in Israel. In the last few decades, their power has grown in great ways, both in government and military. And now we are at a point that Israel is largely supports far right ultra-nationalist policies against Palestinians and foreign policies in general. The left, if it existed really in the universal definition of the left, is very, very marginal. The center is really everything in within Israel's political spectrum has moved to the right. And now the most important constituency in Israel are the settlers and the massive support that the settlers receive within Israel itself, to the point that Israeli politicians themselves, some of Israel's leaders themselves, are themselves settlers. So, and what is the thing that unify the settlers whenever Al-Aqsa Mosque is attacked? Because of this idea that Al-Aqsa Mosque was built thousands of years ago upon a Jewish temple, and the only way to recover the third temple is to destroy Al-Aqsa. Now, regardless of the historical fabrication and the never validated archaeological claims, that's not the issue. The issue is political, meaning that in order for Naftali Bennett, the Prime Minister of Israel, and his shaky coalition government to stay in power, they need to do something so decisive to convince the angry settlers and their supporters that we are doing something about so-called Palestinian violence. We are trying to deal with the issue. Now, they went to the Jenin refugee camp, and they killed a number of people. 12 Palestinians were killed in the last 10 days or so. They have done a lot of these things, but this is business as usual. It doesn't live up to the expectation of the settlers. So Naftali Bennett wanted to do something so dramatic in order for him to send a strong message, not to the Palestinians. We get that. That's the message they always send. So nothing new for us. But the message, the intended audience, is the Israeli settlers, that we are going to hit Palestinians where it hurt. We are going to smash the windows of their holiest shrines, and we are going to send them a message that we are coming to demolish Al-Aqsa at one point. And this is the message that the settlers basically wave and chant every single day when they raid Al-Aqsa. We need to demolish this place, and we need to find the temple. But it works. Sadly, it works. Now, Naftali Bennett is once more seen as the defender of Israel, and Palestinians are left with, you know, with a bleeding nose and you know, humiliated, and their mosque is being trashed. Of course, Palestinians will react to this, and because for them this is a very, very sensitive issue, and Israel is always prepared to retaliate, so-called retaliate, in a disproportionate ways, and so forth and so on. But what really matters is that Naftali Bennett's position is safe for now.
Well, and they've gone further in saying that saying that they're locked for Passover, they're going to lock down, that ubiquitous term, all entry from the West Bank and Gaza into Israel for at least the length of Passover. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today to Dr. Ramzi Baroud. Ramzi is a journalist. He's an author and editor of the Palestine Chronicle. That's at palestinechronicle.com. His book titles include My Father Was a Freedom Fighter, The Last Earth, A Palestinian Story. These Chains Will Be Broken, Palestinian Stories of Struggle and Defiance in Israeli Prisons. And his latest, co-edited with Ilan Pape, is Our Vision for Liberation, Engaged Palestinian Leaders and Intellectuals Speak Out. Ramzi's articles appear across the web and at his website, ramzibaroud.net. And I'm getting to, Ramzi, your recent article, Gaza's Forthcoming Crisis Might Be Worse Than Anything We Have Ever Seen. This concerns the resources in Gaza. Ramzi, I'm looking at a 2012 report from the United Nations agency that's titled Gaza 2020, A Livable Place? There's been a lot of people saying that Gaza is going to be unlivable this year or that year or the next year, and yet life goes on. Is it disingenuous of these organizations, do you think, to posit this question in the first place, or do you feel their intentions are well-meaning?
Well, when the original report came out, Chris, making the claim that Gaza will not be livable in 2020, I remember making an argument then that Gaza was already unlivable, because if the water of a place is I think at the time it was 97% of Gaza's water was undrinkable. And there is no agriculture, real agricultural infrastructure to speak with. And there is no sustainable economic modes whatsoever. And that people are living under a hermetic siege in which they can't even get proper medical treatment outside Gaza, cannot go to their universities, cannot go to their they are isolated. The vast majority of Gaza's population are people who are youth under the age of 18, and the vast majority of all Gazans never actually been outside Gaza, and they are subjected to a constant state of war and siege. Well, the argument then was, how is that livable? I mean, how is that by any meaningful, tangible standards? How was that livable to begin with? But again, we appreciated the warning, thinking that, well, maybe at least that there is a timeline attached to it. It's going to inspire some members of the international community to push against some sort of change. Maybe not enough to push Israel to fully lift the siege on Gaza, but to allow for certain kind of humanitarian aids, to allow maybe for cancer medications, because people are dying from cancer in Gaza with very little, if any, treatment in some cases. Poverty in Gaza is the majority of Gaza's population are existing between poverty and extreme poverty. It was already unlivable. Now, you know, just this notion that, well, is it livable now? What are the bases that anything has changed? To the contrary, now 98% of Gaza's water is undrinkable. More of Gaza's agricultural land that, you know, border the area between Gaza and Israel have been taken by the Israeli military. Snipers are, you know, stationed everywhere at the border. They shoot at farmers. Fishermen can, you know, if they dare venture beyond a certain point, they are shot at, their boats are sunk, they are sometimes are injured and even killed and quite often arrested. So these are the very minimal methods of survival in Gaza, farming and fishing, and that is hardly functional. So there is no question mark here. Gaza is not livable, and the sooner we acknowledge this, the better it will be for Palestinians, because it will give us the needed urgency to actually act upon this piece of information and to try to do something about it. One thing that there's an article I wrote that should be published very soon, in which I spoke about the food crisis in Palestine in general, but in Gaza in particular, as a result of the war in the Ukraine. For example, Amnesty International says that Palestine has enough wheat to last it for 3 weeks. That was about a week ago. So we're talking about 2 weeks and there would be no bread in Palestine. And bread is a very basic food in Palestine and in Gaza in particular. Now, Gaza's situation is even worse than the West Bank. So there's a huge crisis to be added to the water crisis that is imminent and it's building up right now. And again, very, very little attention is being given to this issue, and Israel is just continues with its policies with no regards to Palestinian lives whatsoever.
The attention that we get here, at least, is all mediated by international press, and they have their own agendas, naturally. I'm looking at a page full of headlines from various publications with a simple search of Gaza Today and a news search. And what I get is stuff like from Ynet News, an Israeli-based organization. Their header is Gaza's terror functions to mull response to Israel's offensive measures. The kind of language used it so loads the issue that poor people here in Canada, even those who follow the news regularly, they can't help but form, without vigilance, form skewed opinions on what's going on.
Of course. In fact, I mean, when I was saying that no attention, I mean, not the kind of attention that we want, the kind of attention that recognizes Palestinian humanity and the urgency of the Palestinian situation and the crises, the multiple crises that are taking place all simultaneously in Palestine. But yes, if you're talking about that kind of attention, well, we get a lot of it, to the point that the perception of Palestine is very, very skewed, even among ordinary people who don't know much at all about that region, its politics and its history. But because of this kind of misinformation, which really tells you something about a larger ailment within mainstream media, you know, the more they tell us about an issue, the less we actually understand that issue. Which makes you wonder. I mean, I know it's done on purpose. I know that the idea is not to help people understand facts and to develop positions based on actual information, but they are pushing a narrative. It's always a narrative. On Ukraine, there's a narrative. On Palestine, there's a narrative. On Israel, there's a narrative. On Saudi Arabia, there's a narrative. And that narrative is controlled by very, very clever people in the background who try to kind of create specific discourses and manipulate and push these discourses until everybody thinks the same around these issues. So this means that Palestinians who are, you know, perhaps with the exception of Yemen at this point, the most oppressed people on earth. And you know, if you look at it from a historical point of view, definitely the most oppressed people on earth over time. They appear to average listeners, viewers, readers in the US and Canada, in Europe and many parts of the world to be the aggressors, to be the ones who are just, you know, will never stop making trouble. And Israel is doing everything in its power to maintain its democracy, to do the right thing. They really don't want to torture, but Palestinians force their hands. They really don't want to kill anybody. But those pesky Palestinians do not stop, you know, shooting at them and throwing rockets at them and so forth and so on. And honestly, sometimes, like in a moment of self-reflection, sometimes I wonder if I was just an average American, an average Canadian, just living my life, and for me, the Middle East is not a critical issue to my existence. And I watch the news and I read the newspapers about Palestine and Israel, wouldn't I also develop that sort of perception as well? And I think I would. And that's the problem, is that we can't reach to these audiences because we are blocked. I mean, I quite often blame Palestinians and pro-Palestinians. We are not doing enough. We need to break the obstacle, you know, this hindrances created, the wall that has been erected by mainstream media. We need to get to ordinary people and need to speak to them. But it's not really the lack of trying as much as that we are being prevented from doing so. And constantly, the invalidation of the Palestinian voice and the fact that the Israeli viewpoint is always the center stage of anything concerning Israel, Palestine, in fact, even the Middle East, well, with time, people are going to form these skewed perceptions, and there's very little you can actually do about it. I think what many people don't realize, I mean, because I prayed at Al-Aqsa Mosque, and I know how this works. Let's try to imagine Friday prayer from a Palestinian point of view, okay? I come from, let's say, Ramallah, and I want to cross the Qalandia checkpoint to go and pray in Al-Aqsa. I have to leave very, very early in the morning on Friday, right? And I have to stand in a checkpoint, and there's going to be a large number of Israeli soldiers waiting for me at the checkpoint. And they are, you know, it's going to be my turn eventually. People are going to be tired, exhausted, children crying, people crammed together as if cattle within this narrow pathway. We're going to get to the soldiers, young people, large guns and, you know, whole bunch of military equipments all throughout, the vicinities of that area. And they are going to say, Ramzi, where are you going? And I'm going to go, I'm going to Al-Aqsa Mosque. Do you have a permission? Yes. Do you have a magnetic card? Yes. Do you have the other permission? Yes. I will produce all my papers. They are going to check me. They are going to take my picture, of course, facial recognition right away. And they are going to find out if I'm a troublemaker, meaning that I protested. There is a picture of me carrying a Palestinian flag somewhere. Well, whatever it is, or maybe my distant cousin did something that upset the Israelis. Well, go back, Ramzi. Or, okay, you're allowed in. Finally, I am in, but I'm not into the mosque yet. I go to the mosque, and I have to enter the mosque through several layers of Israeli security. Soldiers, guns, military equipments, rude officers, slapping people, pushing people, punching people, dragging people, arresting people. Imagine that fear-mongering that happens in a single day. I mean, and then if I am lucky, hours and hours later, I lift at dawn, I am there maybe at 12 or at 1, an area that should have taken about 30 minutes to 45 minutes maximum to actually get to the mosque. And when I'm in the mosque, the Israeli helicopters are hovering above me, and Israeli drones are flying all above me, and Israeli soldiers can be seen everywhere, at every gate, at every door, at every spot in which people are not praying. People are praying under guns. And yet that, which happens every single day, but especially on Friday, is not a provocation. That's not a provocation for Western media. A provocation is for a young Palestinian, you know, who just prayed and expressed his faith and his identity and his relationship to his homeland. And when he sees all these people, all these boots on the ground, all of these angry soldiers, all of this abuse of old women, of old men, of young children, families being separated, crying, begging, and then he throws a stone. And then he decides to throw a stone. And then that's only when the provocation starts. Everything that I have mentioned before does not exist in the story whatsoever. Now, this is a microcosm of everything Palestinian. I mean, this is why Al-Aqsa Mosque is symbolic. Even Palestinian atheists, you know, see Al-Aqsa Mosque as a symbol of something that is much bigger than a house of worship or a mosque, because it's a microcosm of everything that Palestinians go through every single day.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Ramzi Brood, and we've tried, Ramzi. I didn't do a very good job of getting to really cover Gaza's next crisis might be worse than anything we've ever seen regarding the water situation in the Gaza Strip there. A situation that you said, and I'll quote you, aside from the ongoing profiteering from water theft, Israel continues to use water as a form of collective punishment in the West Bank, while frequently denying Palestinians, especially in areas, see the right to dig new wells to circumvent the colonial occupation state's water monopoly. Go to the Palestine Chronicle or palestinechronicle.com to read more of Ramzi's work, or ramzibarood.net. Thanks a lot, Ramzi, for coming on again and giving us a perspective that we don't often find on what's going on in Palestine.
Thank you very much, Chris. Keep up the good work.
And I want everyone else to stick around, because Azza Rajbi is going to be right up after the break. We're going to talk about her book on Yemen and the war, the ongoing war there. Thanks again, Ramzi.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Their message always to everybody through all their advertising, all their PR, everything is, we are your friends. And it's like, no, you are not our friends. Friends are not people. Whose bottom line is how much profit they can make out of you. It is completely different.
Guerrilla Radio, knowing who our real friends are since 1999. Right here, 11 a.m. Thursdays at CFUV.ca.
We're running out of time to put out a fire. Fire.
Nos dices que debemos sentarnos, pero las ideas solo pueden levantarnos. Caminar, correr, no rendirse ni retroceder. Ver, aprender cómo esponja absorbe. Nadie sobre todos, faltan todos, suman todos para todos, todo para nosotros. Soñamos en grande que se caiga el imperio. Lo gritamos algo, no queda más remedio. Esto no es utopía, es alegre rebeldía del baile de los que sobran de la danza tuya mía. Levantarnos para desvillevar. África ni América Latina se suba. Un barro con casco, con lápiz a patear el fiasco. Provocar un social terremoto en este charco.
Presents ideas and perspectives of the program's host, not that of CFUV or its staff.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, April begins the eighth year of the world's most dire humanitarian crisis, the asymmetrical conflict in Yemen. There, backed by Western nations, Saudi Arabia has led a coalition of wealthy Arab states in a protracted war that has cost the lives of hundreds of thousands of civilians and threatens millions more. Azza Rajbi is a social justice and anti-racism activist, author, and secretary of Mobilization Against War and Occupation, Vancouver's anti-war coalition. She's also with the Canada-wide Canada Stop Arming Saudi campaign against this country's contribution to the suffering in Yemen, and works in solidarity with Latin America movements, including being a coordinator with Friends of Cuba against the U.S. blockade. Azza too serves on the editorial board of the Fire This Time newspaper, and Azza's 2019 book, U.S. and Saudi War on the People of Yemen, is published by Battle of Ideas Press. Welcome to the show, Azza.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Chris. This is my first time to the show, but I know you've consistently been talking about the issue of Yemen, and I think that's very important. So thanks for that, and I'm glad to be here.
Well, I haven't talked to somebody who's written a book about it, and I'm really anxious to get your take on it, and especially from a Canadian point of view. What is Canada doing right now? What is Canada's role in this ongoing war?
Definitely, Chris. I think that's a really good question and a very important thing to talk about, and that doesn't unfortunately get covered by a lot of the media in Canada. So I'm glad to be here and able to be speaking about this issue, because Canada is basically fueling this humanitarian crisis, this war that's happening in Yemen for over 7 years now. We are entering the eighth year of the war. And even the United Nations have called Canada twice as one of the countries that's fueling the war. One might ask, how is Canada doing this? Canada is one of the countries, along with the United States and other European countries, that have been consistently and are still selling weapons to Saudi Arabia, which is the main country that is leading the war against the people of Yemen. So by continuing to sell weapons to Saudi Arabia, we are continuing to fuel this war. So, for example, since the start of this war in 2015, Canada has exported over $8 billion worth of arms to Saudi Arabia. So basically, the Liberal government of Canada is making profit at the expense of Yemeni lives. This war has created a tragedy in Yemen. It is the world's worst humanitarian crisis. And what is Canada doing? Sending more weapons, fueling this war more and more.
Well, in 2019, Azza, the same year that your book was released, Canada signed an international treaty, the Arms Treaty Agreement, that Canada said it would not export arms into conflict areas. That was a part of the treaty. And yet they're still selling arms to the Saudis, as you mentioned. How does Canada rectify these two seemingly disparate positions?
Exactly. That's a very good point, Chris, because I think that's a point that unfortunately shows the hypocrisy of the government of Canada. On one point, signing such a treaty, and then on the other point, continuing to arm and fund and sell weapons to Saudi Arabia. And Canada also, another important piece is that the Liberal Trudeau government has said that they were going to look and review this arms sales that they have with Saudi Arabia. They paused them for a little bit. They went and reviewed them, and then they came back and basically said, all is good here, nothing to see. We're going to continue selling weapons to Saudi Arabia. And this is total hypocrisy by the Canadian government. But we can look at it from the point of view of how basically Saudi Arabia, after the United States, is the largest buyer of Canadian military goods. And so, of course, unfortunately, Canada is prioritizing profit for the big manufacturing of military and weaponries, as opposed to prioritizing the life of the people of Yemen. And so we are continuing, the government of Canada is continuing to sell weapons to Saudi Arabia to fuel this war, despite the hypocrisy that you're pointing out, Chris, and many other hypocrisies, really, that Canada is talking about being a champion of human rights, and Trudeau being a feminist leader and championing human rights around the world, while continuing to arm a country like a monarchy like Saudi Arabia, who is having human rights abuses against their own people, but also have been killing and continuing this war against the people of Yemen for over 7 years now.
Well, we've suffered Justin Trudeau for just as long, and he's reversed himself on many positions in that period. What are the opposition in the House saying about the continuing Canadian supplying of arms to the belligerent Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, and unfortunately, the issue of Yemen has not been really at the front of discussions either in the media of Canada or in the Parliament of Canada. But it's also important to point out that different members of the Parliament from the NDP have supported and sponsored petition to the Parliament of Canada against the sales of weapons. So we had a petition last year, a coalition of organizations, including us in Vancouver with Mobilization Against War and Occupation, other groups from across Canada. We came together under an umbrella that is Canada Stop Arming Saudi. And we reached out to different members of parliament. And so at that time, MP Matthew Green, and also this time, MP Matthew Green, who's the NDP member of parliament, has sponsored this petition. So we are continuing this campaign to try to bring the issue more to the front of the Parliament of Canada, because it doesn't get as much coverage as it should. And so we know, for example, that the NDP have stated their position that they are against this arms trade, that they are against Canada continuing to sell weapons to Saudi Arabia. So did the Green Party. Of course, the Liberal and the Conservative have not broken their support for this campaign, for this continued selling of weapons to Saudi Arabia. So as peace activists, as anti-war activists across Canada, it is our duty to continue to put pressure on the government and the parliament. And so this petition, and I actually would invite folks that are listening here today and are wondering, what can I do? What can I do to add pressure to my member of parliament, whether I live in Victoria, whether I live in Vancouver, in Manitoba, in anywhere around Canada? These little things that as the Canada Stop Arming Saudi Coalition, we are inviting people to do. And this too, and I will just explain to people quickly, is that we have, as I mentioned, this petition sponsored by MP Matthew Green. It is open for signatures. People are encouraged to sign it and share it. And we also have created a tool that helps you to send an email directly to your member of parliament and where you are expressing your opposition to the war, but specifically your opposition to Canada continuing to sell arms to Saudi Arabia. So if folks are interested in signing the petition or sending the letter to a member of parliament, they visit the Mobilization Against War and Occupation website, which is www.maovancouver.org. I apologize. It's www.maovancouver.org. You can find these tools. And I really encourage people to join us in this, because we have to put pressure on the government of Canada. This issue is silent. This war has been going on for over 7 years. And member of parliaments rarely speak about it. So by joining together with folks all across Canada, our voice matter to put pressure on the government of Canada, saying this is enough, this war is enough, the complicity of the government of Canada is enough.
Well, and again, that is Trudeau, Stop Arming Saudi Arabia, Canada, Stop Arming Saudi. Go to the website, and that is maovancouver.org, so you can sign on to the petition, as mentions there. As I will, about this ongoing disaster in Yemen, it's difficult to get consistent information about it, even about something as simple as the amount of casualties being suffered. Even when you go to organizations like Human Rights Watch, the numbers vary wildly. Can you give us a source of information on what's happening in Yemen that you trust?
Yeah, that's actually a very good point, Chris, because that just shows really the general media silence and the lack of interest in the issue of Yemen. As you said, there is very little information. When anybody tries to find what's going on in Yemen, there is, as you mentioned, there is not a lot of clear numbers or clear statistics. And part of that is that we have to remember that the Saudi-led coalition has also been imposing a blockade on Yemen. This is an air, a land, and a sea blockade, which means also that it's really hard for a lot of the different aid organizations and humanitarian organizations to actually send their staff or to be able to work inside of Yemen collecting this data or collecting this different information, seeing what's really happening on the ground in Yemen is really hard. And a lot of the data that comes from what's happening in Yemen, a lot of the time, as you mentioned, can be conflicting and not very straightforward. But the United Nations actually has been releasing data, unfortunately, a little bit too late generally. But for example, their most recent data is that basically almost 400,000 people were killed during this war on Yemen. If we think about this, almost 400,000 people is tremendous loss of life in this war that has been going for too long. And so for myself, whenever I'm researching or I'm looking for information on Yemen, there's certain data that I can use from the United Nations, but also at the same time, I try to look at different sources, whether that is Yemeni sources from the ground, like I said, the United Nations sources, but I also spend a lot of time reading articles and looking at Twitter at videos, and it does help me that I'm speaking Arabic. I'm originally from Tunisia, so I can also read articles and information in Arabic, which a lot of it, unfortunately, doesn't necessarily get translated. So it actually is hard and involves a lot of researching sometimes to try to find what's really going on and what is the real situation. And it is, again, this is horrific because this war has been going for too long and it has to stop. And this media silence around this war is also horrific because it's a sort of complicity when we watch the news in Canada or the United States, and there is very, very little coverage about what's happening in Yemen.
Well, and to provide some kind of context for people here, that 400,000 constitutes, I guess, every man, woman, and child between the city here and Duncan, probably including Duncan, killed everyone.
Yeah, it's even more horrific when you think about it in terms of like that context of what does that actually mean? And another really horrific statistic from the war on Yemen is, and this is really like sad and angering to think about, that a Yemeni child dies every 75 seconds. So every 75 seconds, a Yemeni child dies from starvation. Starvation is preventable, is something that we can do something about. But again, this war is continuing, this humanitarian crisis is continuing with big silence from all over the world. And it's horrific to see. So that's why I invite folks that are listening to try to get involved in opposing this war, whether that if you're in Victoria or if you're somewhere on the island, join a peace coalition near you. If you're here in Vancouver, join us at Mobilization Against War and Occupation. If you're in Toronto, you can attend actions that World Beyond War is organizing. Basically, I'm inviting folks to join any anti-war coalition that is in their city, or even do actions online. Write letters to your member of parliament. Give them a call. Pick up the phone and call your MP and say, hey, I've heard this interview today on Guerrilla Radio. I thought about this, and I think Canada should not be selling weapons to Saudi Arabia. Any pressure that we can continue putting on the government of Canada is very important.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today to Azza Rajbi. Azza is a social justice and anti-racism activist. She's an author and secretary of the Mobilization Against War and Occupation, Vancouver's anti-war coalition. She's also with the Canada-wide Canada Stop Arming Saudi campaign against this country's contribution to that horrible war there, and is a coordinator with the Friends of Cuba Against the U.S. Blockade. And she serves as on the editorial board of the Fire This Time newspaper. Her book is U.S. and Saudi War on the People of Yemen, and it's published by Battle of Ideas Press. Well, as I it is hard to find news, and I was searching around today to see what was the latest. We did have good news, though, a couple weeks ago, a couple days preceding the beginning of Ramadan. There was an announcement that there would be a truce, the first since 2016, and it was announced that it would last through Ramadan and a month beyond as well. What's the status of that truce so far, do you know?
This step toward peace, this latest step toward peace, was forged by this Yemeni people resistance against this ongoing war by the Saudi coalition on their country. And it's important that for this step to lead into a lasting peace, we need to see more than this. Unfortunately, this is not the first ceasefire that was announced in this last 7 years of war. And we are optimistic, but also cautious that for this to become to lead into a lasting peace, the Saudi-led coalition has to be really committed to opening all ports and have opening access to the Sana'a airport, which has been closed As I said, Saudi Arabia, part of the war, has been imposing a blockade. So to see a ceasefire is great, but it needs to continue. And it also needs to be part of a bigger picture where all Yemeni voices join together for peace talk. And I think another important demand and another important angle to this is that countries like Canada and the United States have to stop fueling this war. We cannot talk about a ceasefire and a lasting peace when we are constantly arming Saudi Arabia, when we are constantly fueling this war by sending more weapons. We need to be calling for the continuation of the ceasefire. We need to be holding the Saudi-led coalition accountable that they reopen all access to all the ports, to the Sana'a airports, that all foreign troops that are now fighting in Yemen need to be out of the country. All the military occupation by the Saudi forces and the Saudi allied forces need to be out of the country. This is an opportunity for a lasting peace, but it needs to be taken seriously. And part of it is us here in Canada, in the United States and other countries, putting pressure on our own governments here, the government of Canada, to talk about peace and stop fueling by sending more weapons to Saudi Arabia and holding Saudi Arabia accountable on their actions. And so this is a positive step, but again, cautiously, we watch it and we continue putting pressure on the government of Canada to make this go into a lasting peace by stopping fueling this war and holding the Saudi government accountable.
From what I read, I understood that the airport at Sana'a would be open at last and that the port too would be open. Are you saying that that's not the case?
Technically, that is what was agreed on. But we've seen that the ports have been partially open. So some ships that are bringing aid were able to dock in the airports, specifically the airport of Hodeidah. But the Sana'a airport, it is not open yet. And so some ships have been able to dock, but the Sana'a airport is not open yet. And that is very important because we're talking about a country, as I said, is the world's worst humanitarian crisis, which means that there is very little access to adequate healthcare all over the country in Yemen. And the Sana'a airport is very important because a lot of people are depending on commercial flights resuming to be able to go outside of the country, get access to treatment for cancer, dialysis, all regular treatment that living here in Canada, you take for granted that you can just go to the hospital and have access to that. People in Yemen don't have that. And the Sana'a airport represents a lifeline for a lot of people that want to be able to leave Yemen to go to neighboring country to have access to that treatment. So as of today, and as we're recording this interview today on April 16, the Sana'a airport is still closed.
The United States has announced a new naval task force for the Red Sea that they say is being set up to interdict with smugglers. Is this, do you feel, as is this just a move by the Americans and their allies to keep the blockade against the Yemeni ports in place?
Again, and that shows partly why the cautiousness about the ceasefire is because, you know, it looks good in paper, but how is the application of it? How is that going? And as you mentioned, what the United States is doing sounds more like an escalation than helping to achieve a lasting peace. For context and to understand, one might wonder, well, why is this important? This strait is one of the most active and vital maritime shipping routes in the world. So the United States' constant intervention in the affairs of Yemen and other countries in the region is part of that, is part of trying to push their own agenda for their own military and economic hegemony. And so that's why here in Canada or the United States, our voices need to be loud against any intervention by the United States and their allies in the region. Enough is enough. We've seen more and more destruction by different interventions that the United States led throughout all our region in Africa and the Middle East, what we call a mobilization against war on occupation, the new era of war on occupation. Since the occupation of Afghanistan in 2001, unfortunately, the United States, Canada, as one of their allies and other allies, have been imposing more and more wars and sanctions, occupations, breaking the sovereignty of different nations in the region and forcing them to be puppets, basically, for, you know, the hegemony of the United States. So this latest action is dangerous and is an escalation by the United States. And we need to oppose any actions like that does not add to the conversation of peace and only escalates what is already a horrific situation in the region.
I'm looking at a Press TV report, too, and they quote Mohammed Abdul Salam, who is noted here as the head of the Houthi negotiation team. And he is saying of this task force, this American task force, and I'll quote him, he says, the American move in the Red Sea in light of a humanitarian and military truce in Yemen contradicts Washington's claim that it supports the truce. Rather, it only seeks to perpetuate the state of aggression and siege on Yemen. That is from Press TV, of course, is an Iranian outlet where Al Jazeera is in the Gulf. What about this? We're often presented with the fact that what's going on in Yemen is merely a proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Could you clarify the nuance there between the proxy war and the concerns of Yemenis and their civil war?
As you said, I want to reiterate again that this is very important to talk about in terms of what the United States is doing is an escalation. When we're talking about a lasting peace, you don't you don't provoke or send any more military presence in the region. And this issue of talking about Iran, I think, is important because Saudi Arabia has been, and the media has been using it as a justification to meddling in the region and to their war against the people of Yemen. And actually, it's kind of interesting to see sometimes the mainstream media label Yemen's Houthis and any actually Yemeni resistance as Iranian puppets. And this is what the mainstream media in the United States love to say about anyone that opposes the Saudi-led aggression in Yemen. This is basically, you know, it's easier, they use it because it's easier for them to dismiss and justify the destruction of Yemen by just calling everybody, you know, an evil Iranian proxy, which is basically not true. The people of Yemen are fighting and are resisting for the sovereignty of their own country. And it's also actually important to point out that sometimes the mainstream media and the U.S. Officials themselves are saying, in some ways, they say the truth. For example, I remember I was reading an article from Al Monitor News sometime in 2019, I believe, and it quoted Gerald Fernstein, who is a former U.S. ambassador to Yemen under former President Obama. And so he himself, when asked about what is really the situation in terms of Iran in Yemen, he said, here I'm quoting what he said, and this is a former U.S. ambassador to Yemen. He says, the Houthis have never been proxies of Iran. They never followed Iranian leadership guidance. And so it's important that I want to address that a lot of the times this reporting of the war on Yemen is used by mainstream media to find an opportunity to blame Iran for this crisis. Iran is not the country that has been bombing Yemen for 7 years. And actually, it's sometimes really kind of interesting to watch. And maybe this is kind of a little bit of a challenge to folks listening in. If you're reading news about what's going on in Yemen next time, either you're watching a video and reading an article, I've noticed sometimes that they've actually mentioned the word Iran in the videos more than they mentioned the word Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia is actually the country that is been bombing Yemen for 7 years. And so I think this is important because by labeling all resistance to Saudi Arabia's aggression in Yemen as, quote, Iranian puppets, the media is part of vilifying and dismissing anybody in Yemen that is resisting or speaking out against Saudi Arabia. It also kind of is used to justify the atrocities committed against the people of Yemen and justify that this has been going for over 7 years now.
Well, and we see the same thing when looking at eastern Ukraine and the breakaway republics of Donbass and Lugansk. They're just called Russian-supported rebels and language like this, and not that they have legitimate aspirations of their own to be independent of the fascist rulers of Kiev.
Yeah, and actually, Chris, since you brought this up, I think and that's definitely a good point. I would also add that the response of Canada to the situation in Ukraine is also another way to see how hypocritical the government of Canada is. So as I mentioned earlier, in addition to profiting from the war, Canada's making billions of dollars selling weapons to Saudi Arabia. and disregarding really a humanitarian crisis there. But also Canada joined other Western countries like the US and others in disregarding the plight of Yemeni refugees. While we have hundreds of thousands of Yemeni refugees are stranded in different transit countries, you'll be surprised to hear that, and some of your listeners too, as Canada has only resettled 340 refugees from Yemen between January 2015 to January 2022. This is very, very shameful to hear only 340 Yemeni refugees have been resettled in Canada since 2015. In contrast, we now know, you know, you just have to open the news, you'll see how much Canada is proud with welcoming Ukrainian refugee. Canada has opened its doors wide for Ukrainians, creating Canada-Ukraine authorization for emergency travel, eliminating a lot of the fees and paperwork for visa requirement. There's no limits to how many Ukrainian nationals can apply. Their application will be prioritized. They might stay up in Canada up to 3 years. Where is all of this for Yemenis? This war has been happening for almost 8 years now. We're entering the 8th year of this war. And we've only, not we, the government of Canada, only let in 340 refugees from Yemen. This is a very racist approach by the government of Canada toward refugees. And it's a preferential approach. It's a preferential treatment that indicates and show how the government of Canada is disregarding the life of thousands of Yemenis.
It may be racist and it may not be racist, but I would posit firstly that Canada is afraid of insulting Saudi Arabia, especially as it's got so much investment in this country, not least of which is the Canadian the Canadian wheat board, which is now the Saudi Arabian wheat board. So it's not so much the nature of the refugee, but who the refugee is running from, I think, is a major consideration. As far as media goes, again, Qatar is the home base of Al Jazeera, and they're involved in this on the other side. So we're not going to get much, as they say, they provide, they guarantee, I'm just looking at their site now, that you can rely on Al Jazeera for truth and transparency. But in this issue, I'd say you're not going to find either coming from them. You know what, people, what you have to do, actually, if you want to get any idea of what's going on, go to Mobilization Against War and Occupation. That is mawovancouver.org. You can find Azza and her colleagues' works there, and references to media that you can trust and to sign those petitions that I mentioned earlier, mawovancouver.org. Azza Rajbi, thanks a lot for coming on the program. And can you tell us before we go how people can get their hands on your book, U.S. and Saudi War on the People of Yemen?
Yes, definitely. And well, first, thank you. Thank you very much, Chris, for this opportunity. I think it's very important to continue talking about this situation in Yemen. Doesn't get as much coverage. So I'm really happy that I was able to be here today and talk with you and have this very important conversation. And so again, thanks for this opportunity. And if folks are interested in buying my book, it is available. It's published by Battle of Ideas Press. And the website for that is www.battleofideaspress.com. And they can buy it there. The book is available. You can order it online. It is $10, and you'll be able to pay through the website via PayPal, and then it'll be shipped to you.
Wow, that's terrific. Well, thanks again, Azza, for coming on. And I want to also thank Ramzi Baroud. And remind you, everybody, just stick around because there's great programming coming up. You know that, but that's all I've got for this week. Until the next time, thanks again, Azza.
Thanks, Chris.
Napo. Mil veces venceremos. Del cielo al suelo y del suelo al cielo vamos. Caballito blanco, vuelve pa' tu pueblo. No te tenemos miedo, tenemos vida y fuego. Fuego en nuestras manos, fuego en nuestros ojos. Tenemos tanta vida y esta fuerza color rojo. La